Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, a special podcast about Pesach. This would be a great podcast to mention to your friends, and remember to tell them that they don't need an iPod to listen to the podcast. A computer with speakers will do fine. The podcast this week is from a new presenter for the podcast series. Nima Novetsky is a faculty member of Pardes, specializing in Tanakh. And now, Nima Novetsky.
Every year at our seders, we say, Chayav Adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatza mimitzrayim. Each person is obligated to see himself as if he left Egypt. In the next 25 minutes or so, let's attempt to do just that. To put ourselves back in time, and to recreate for ourselves what the experience of slavery was like in Egypt. How did it all begin? What did the daily life of a slave look like? And finally, how did the slaves view Moshe and the possibility of freedom? What we want to do is not so easy, because Sefer Shmot is not in the slightest a running slave narrative. One has to look at Psukim from here, other verses from there, and piece them all together to form a whole. Sometimes, also, it's helpful to turn away from Sefer Shmot, to look at other models of slavery, to look at models like the slavery in Southern America, to look at more contemporary cases of slavery, and to see how these might shed light back on the Shmot narrative. So let's start at the beginning. How did Shibud Mitzrayim start? As we all know from Sefer Bereishit, when Am Yisrael arrived in Egypt, they enjoyed a privileged status. After all, Yosef was second to the king. So how is it that when we turn the page from the end of Bereishit to the first page of Sefer Shmot, how is it that they become a nation of slaves? What happened in the middle? Tanakh tells us. It's perhaps not so surprising. Circumstances had changed. A new dynasty had begun. Am Yisrael were now seen as a threat. Fear of their power grows. Probably the fact that they're foreigners, the fact that they're different, does not help matters. And very likely, jealousy of their privileged status all played a part in the enslavement and the oppression. But the enslavement of an entire nation cannot and does not happen overnight. And so when we look at chapter 1 of Sefer Shmot, we see a process. We see various stages of oppression, various stages of enslavement. First, Paro decides that Bnei Israel will become slaves. Then, Paro commands that the midwives kill all of the children. And finally, he commands the ordinary Egyptians that they too can throw all male Israelites into the Yaor. Ramban looks at our chapter, and he tries to understand these various stages. He says, what is it that made Paro act as he did? What was the logic behind Paro's actions? He looks at the words of Paro, Havad nitchakmalo, let us act in wisdom or trickery to them. And he asks, what need was there of trickery? Why did Paro have to use tricks, have to use deceit to get what he wanted of Bnei Israel? He was the king. He could have done whatever he wanted. And where do we see this trickery anyway in the process of enslavement that we just described? Ramban points to verse 11, the first stage of slavery. V'yasimu alav sarei misim leman anoto b'sivlotam v'yiven arei miskinot leparo et pitom v'et Ramses. And they placed upon them tax officers in order to oppress them, and they built pitom and Ramses. Ramban points out, hitil behem mas kiderach hagarim ba'aretz la'alot mas la'melech kemo sheba b'shlomo. Paro begins by instituting a labor tax. If we look at the verse carefully, we note that what's going on here is not enslavement in the usual sense of the term, says Ramban, but rather a labor tax, something which is not at all unusual, something which, Ramban points out, even Shlomo HaMelech did. He too asked the people to go and work for free. Many kings did similarly, and it was very possible that Bnei Israel were not the only ones who were forced into such labor. And if they happened to be work slightly harder than the others, who in the world would know? The second stage of the oppression is introduced in verse 13. Ve'yavidu Mitzrayim et b'nei Yisrael b'farach. The word Mitzrayim here is ambiguous. It could mean Mitzrayim as in Egypt, the state, in which case there's no new form of oppression being introduced here. But the word Mitzrayim can also refer to the Egyptians, the individuals. Perhaps the plural form of the word Ve'yavidu supports such a reading. If so, then the verse is describing a new stage. We've moved from state labor to individual slave owners. Rambam points out that the second stage of slavery, or the second slave of the oppression, was when Paro talked to the midwives, telling them, "Laharog hascharim al ha'avnaim, va'afilo hayoldot atzman lo yidu." The midwives would kill the babies on the birthing stones, and they would do it in such a manner that even the mothers themselves would never know that the babies had been killed. They would assume instead that the babies were stillborns. Throughout, what is Paro doing? He's acting in such a way that no one would know that all of these commands come from him. Everything would be seen to be the norm, would be an accidental death. Finally, we reach the last stage of the oppression, when Paro tells the people themselves to kill the babies. Ramban explains, "V'ha'inyan shelo ratza l'tzavot l'sarei tabachim asher lo l'hargam b'charev, aval amar la'am kasher yimtza kol achad yeled, yashlich oto b'ya'or, v'yimtza k'avi ha'yeled ha'lamelech, yomru sh'yavi edim, v'yayase bo nikama." The king didn't tell his own officers to do the killing. He didn't want it to be seen as charev ha'melech, as the sword of the king. He didn't want it to be seen as an official killing. Rather what? It should appear as a spontaneous uprising by the people. Ramban suggests that the Israelites could have even brought these Egyptians to trial. Of course, the assumption is the Egyptians would have been exonerated, but Bnei Israel were never to know that. Eventually, Ramban suggests, once the people had been given a little leeway, the killing became the norm. The spontaneous uprising really was a spontaneous uprising. People voluntarily went out to search out the homes of the Jews to find babies. Sforno similarly explains the transition from state to individual slave owners, and he writes, "Kishera'u otam mivazim et atzmam lepu'ula pechuta, samu otam la'avadim." As soon as the nation was degraded by being forced into slave labor, even if it was labor for the king, as soon as they were given the label slave, that's how they were viewed by all. It wasn't such a far step to move from that to individual enslavement. I think that both Ramban and Sforno in their explanations are probably influenced not just by a close reading of the Psukim, but very likely by their own knowledge of human psychology and governmental policies. If we look back to the model of American slavery, for example, we see that there too slavery did not start overnight. In describing the institution of American slavery, Daniel Borstein writes, "Decades passed after his first arrival in the American colonies before the Negro acquired the status of a slave. During most of the 17th century, the Virginia Negroes, who were described as not free, were not necessarily slaves. The opposite of free in those days was not slave, but unfree. And there were many gradations of unfreedom. The involuntary servitude of delinquent debtors, the forced servitude on public works by vagrants, the labors of orphans, and the servitude for a term of years voluntarily undertaken by an indenture. In the first decades in Virginia, then, the status of the Negro was not peculiar. He shared his servile condition with many. But as the demand for labor increased and the cost of labor rose, Negroes were gradually reduced to chattel slavery, and they were not in a position to protest. Until finally, Virginia enacted that all servants, not being Christians, brought in by sea, were to be slaves for life. The blacks, too, did not begin as slaves, but as indentured servants or similar. Their status was like many others around them. It was only with time, once their status was already a degraded one, once they were no longer in a position to protest, that they moved from low to lower to lower until they were reduced to chattel slavery. It doesn't take much to find other examples closer in time. If we look, for example, at Germany in the period of World War II, we see in practice exactly what Sforno was talking about. You have dozens and dozens of so-called friends, so-called neighbors of Jews, who quickly turned their backs, who quickly became foes once the Jew's status had changed. So too, it seems, it was like with Bnei Israel and the Egyptians. Relationships didn't change overnight. The process was a much more gradual one, to some extent done in private, in a way that no one knew until the process was almost over. We don't know how long it took, but by the end of the period described in chapter 1 of Sefer Shmot, slavery and oppression were in full swing. And this brings us to our second question. What was life like as a slave? Is the model of American slavery at all comparable? Was degradation, dehumanization, beatings, family separations, were all those part of the experience of Bnei Israel? What types of work were they expected to do? Who was enslaved? Who was not? I think many of us have a picture of slaves in our heads. We have this picture of individuals without home, without possessions, nothing to call their own, people who are bought and sold at will, people who are often separated from their families, never to see them again, people who are in general treated as property, treated as dirt. One well-known slave, Frederick Douglass, describes a slave sale. He writes, "We were all ranked together at the valuation. Men and women, old and young, married and single, were ranked with horses, sheep, and swine. There were horses and men, cattle and women, pigs and children, all holding the same rank in the scale of being, and were all subject to the same narrow examination. After the valuation, then came the division. I have no language to express the high excitement and deep anxiety which were felt among us poor slaves during this time. Our fate for life was now to be decided. A single word from the white man was enough, against all our wishes, prayers, and entreaties, to sunder forever the dearest friends, dearest kindred, and strongest ties known to human beings." Douglass describes a situation in which men are equated with animals, a situation where at one word from a white man, a black man might be separated forever from his loved ones. In Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, she similarly captures the pain of those separated from loved one. One of the slaves in the book, Cassie, writes or says, "I've hungered for my children and thirsted for them, and my eyes fill with longing for them. Here, here," she said, striking her breast, "it's all desolate, all empty." With these pictures in mind, we turn back to Sefer Shmot. But when we do, it seems that these are perhaps not the best models by which to understand what was going on in Mitzrayim. Because in fact, the picture in Sefer Shmot is quite a different one than the one we just viewed. When we look at family units in Tanakh, in Sefer Shmot, it seems that for the most part, they were actually kept intact. Looking at Perek Bet, chapter 2, which introduces the birth of Moshe, the feeling one has is of a close family, father, mother, sister, all living together under one roof. We have an Ish Mibeit HaLevi going to marry a Bat Levi. The woman is pregnated. A son is born. She hides him for 3 months. Later we read of the sister going out to check on the status of her baby brother. The portrait here is a family who, yes, fears the killing of their newborn baby, but does not fear the potential separation of their family due to slave sales. The portrait is also one of a family who seems to be living in their own home, not in the slave quarters of some Egyptian's house. Other verses similarly suggest that Bnei Yisrael were not dispersed throughout the country, each in the home of a different slave owner, but rather that they all lived in one area, the city of Goshen. During Makat Barad, for example, we read, "Rak be'eretz Goshen asher sham Bnei Yisrael lo haya Barad." Hashem brings the Barad down on all of the Egyptians. One area, though, the area of Goshen, there's no Barad. Why? Because that's the area where Bnei Yisrael lived. Again, Bnei Yisrael don't seem to be interspersed amongst the homes of the Egyptians. During Makat Bechorot, similarly, we read of the command to put blood on the doorpost. That way, the angel of death will skip over the houses of Bnei Israel and only attack those of the Mitzrim. This too, of course, only makes sense if Am Yisrael lived alone in their own houses and not together with the Mitzrim. Furthermore, Bnei Israel also seem to have their own possessions. In chapter 10, when Moshe tries to convince Paro to let Bnei Israel leave to worship Hashem, he says, "Bitzoneinu ubivkareinu nelech." We will take our sheep and cattle with us. Apparently then, Am Yisrael had sheep and cattle. They owned their own animals. I think there's another point that we tend to assume as fact, but might also be a misconception. We often have a picture of Bnei Israel working daily with no breaks, of an entire nation being enslaved. Just like Frederick Douglass writes of his own experiences, we were worked fully up to the point of endurance, long before day we were up. We were often in the field from the first approach of day till its last lingering gray had left us. So too, I think, we often feel Bnei Israel worked. This exhausting, never-ending labor, though, might not be as true of Bnei Israel. If what is described in chapter 1 was a work tax, as we mentioned before, then it's possible that at any given point, only some of the nation were slaves. In support of this, one might look at the story about Aaron going off to greet Moshe when Moshe is in Midian. If Aaron is a slave, how is it possible that he could freely leave Egypt to wander off to go meet his brother in the desert at any time that he wants? This, by the way, leads Chazal to suggest that Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi as a whole, were not slaves. But even if one doesn't go that far, it is possible that people had shifts and that they were slaves for a month, home for a week, slaves for a month, home for a month. That said, I don't mean to give the impression that life was easy for Bnei Israel. It definitely was not. They were not exempt from back-breaking labor, nor its effect on embittering the lives of all affected. We're all familiar with the verse in chapter 1, "Vayimareru et chayehem ba'avodah kasha, b'chomer u'bilvenim, u'v'chol avodah basadeh, et kol avodatam asher avdu bahem b'farach." Yes, the Egyptians embittered the lives of Bnei Israel with hard labor. They had to make bricks. They had to do all sorts of tasks in the field. Life was not an easy one. All those beatings that we're familiar with from all the different slave narratives had their parallels for Am Yisrael. When we read of Moshe looking out the palace window and seeing the Egyptian hit the Hebrew, this is probably just one example of a fairly common occurrence. Something that probably happened on a daily basis to many, many, many Hebrews. There are some southern slaves who recount how they had a quota of cotton to pick daily. A slave by the name of Charles Bell writes how his master fixed the day's work at 50 pounds. When one reads this, one can't help but turn to chapter 5 of Sefer Shmot, where we see Paro similarly setting a quota of bricks, and of course punishing any who did not meet that quota. I think there's one last area of comparison, which touches not on the daily life of the slave, but on their desire for freedom. I think we often assume that any slave, given half a chance, would go and escape. He would jump at the opportunity of freedom. We have this picture of shackles on their feet, but given the key, every slave would undo those shackles and run away. Thus, when we read in Uncle Tom's Cabin how Tom's kindly master, St. Clair, tells him that he's to free him, his response is exactly what we expect. A sudden light of joy shone in Tom's face as he raised his hands to heaven. "Blessed be the Lord." When his master suggests to him that maybe he shouldn't be so emphatic in his joy, after all, things weren't so bad under this good master, Tom agrees, but he points out, "No, no, master, it ain't that. It's being a free man. That's what I'm joying for." When he's reminded that chances are that as a free man, he would never have enjoyed such comfort as he had by his master, Tom replies, "Knows that, Master St. Clair. Master's been too good. But master, I'd rather have poor clothes, poor house, poor everything, and have them mine than have the best and have them any man else's." Perhaps surprisingly, such feelings were not shared by all slaves. For some, freedom seemed so unrealistic. The work was so hard, the slave so tired, that he couldn't even begin to dream about sleep, about freedom. He didn't even hear it when it was suggested. And so we read of Bnei Israel, "V'lo shamu el Moshe mikotze ruach o me'avodah kasha." Bnei Israel didn't even hear Moshe's telling them that he's going to free them. They were so busy working. They were so distraught from their hard labors. Others were so entrenched in the slave-master relationship that they couldn't even fathom such a thing. Rebellion was out of question. It was not something that they would have dared think of. In fact, it seems that it was quite rare that actual plantation laborers themselves planned slave revolts. In his work about American slavery, Stanley Elkin writes, "Revolts that broke out in the South were in no instance planned by plantation laborers, but rather by Negroes whose quality of leadership were developed well outside the full coercions of the plantation authority system. Someone growing up in the system, someone that had that slave-master relationship, would never have planned a revolt. It's perhaps no coincidence, then, that it's Moshe, the one person amongst Am Yisrael who grew up in the palace, who had never been a slave. It is he, the free man, who is able to lead Bnei Yisrael out of Egypt." Ibn Ezra writes, "Ulai savav Hashem ze, sheigdal Moshe bevit machut, liot nafsho al hamadriga ha'elyona, v'lo tiyesh shveila v'rigila liot bevit avadim." Perhaps God arranged things, says Ibn Ezra, so that Moshe would grow up in a palace. Moshe would grow up far away from slavery, far away from all those humiliations, because only such could he become the leader, the person who would be able to stand up to Paro, to stand up to the master, and take Bnei Israel out. For many other slaves, even though in principle they might have agreed with the idea of freedom, in practice they didn't, because any attempt at escape, any attempt at revolt, was a threat. Because if it didn't succeed, punishment was sure to come. And even if it did succeed for another slave, all those left behind were sure to be the victims of the master's wrath. And so we find lots and lots of stories of slaves trying to dissuade others from escaping, of slaves who go and join the master in his hunt for fugitives. On this backdrop, it's not so hard to understand Bnei Israel's reaction to Moshe. One would have thought that when Moshe arrived on the scene, he would be hailed as the savior. He comes to free the people. Everyone should have looked up to him. But that's not what we see. In chapter 2, after Moshe kills the Egyptian who had been hitting the Hebrew slave, one of Am Yisrael accuses him. Moshe is seen as the threat. His action might cause negative retribution on all the slaves. And the truth is, the slaves' fears are not for naught. Because when Moshe does come in chapter 5, and he does talk to Paro to free Bnei Israel, the result is that Paro makes the work even harder. And Am Yisrael go and cry out to Moshe in frustration, "Why do you have to come?" But even when freedom is clearly a reality, even sometimes after a slave is freed, not all slaves greet this freedom with enthusiasm. In an article in Scientific America, Stephen Bales writes about modern slavery. He speaks of one man named Baldev, who had been in debt bondage, but was finally able to pay his debt off and free himself. Baldev says, "We paid off our debt and were free to do whatever we wanted. But I was worried all the time. What if one of the children got sick? What if our crop failed? What if the government wanted some money? Since we no longer belonged to the landlord, we didn't get food every day as before. Finally, I went to the landlord and asked him to take me back." This actually mirrors the picture of Bnei Israel after they are freed. They find themselves in the Midbar, and every obstacle they greet, every obstacle that comes in their way, what do they say? "Let's go back to Mitzrayim. Let's go back to Egypt." When there's no food, they tell Moshe, "Zacharnu et hadaga asher nochal b'Mitzrayim, et ha-kishuim v'et ha-batichim." They miss the fish that they used to eat in Mitzrayim. They miss the food that they were provided with as slaves. Bnei Israel are afraid of independence. They're afraid of freedom. Because with both also comes responsibility. With both also comes an unknown. Stephen Bales also writes of women trafficking and the difficulty of freeing oneself even from that. He points out, "To live in slavery, the young women often redefine their bondage as a duty or a job or a form of penance. To accept their role in the pimps, they must try to diminish their view of themselves as victims who have been wronged. They must begin to see their enslavement from the point of view of the slaveholder. At the time of the author's visit, the women in the brothel were at various stages in a process of submission. Some were even allowed to visit their families during holidays, for they always came back. In spite of the violence, in spite of the living and working conditions, people in slavery have their own mental integrity, their own mechanisms for surviving. Some may actually like different aspects of their lives, perhaps the security or their understanding of the order of things. When you disrupt that order, suddenly everything is confused. For some of these women, slavery had been the major psychological building block in their lives. When that was destroyed, the meaning of their life was like a bit of paper crushed up and thrown away. Often, it seems, slaves grow into their positions. They become proud of their accomplishments. They define their very beings as slaves, so much so that the thought of freedom is actually a scary one. To some extent, it means that their previous life held no meaning. So going back to Shmot, yes, there was probably a large portion of Am Yisrael who, like Uncle Tom, brightened at Moshe's arrival. They were eager to leave, willing to follow this unknown leader as long as he would bring them freedom. But there were also quite a few who were probably unsure, who were afraid of the unknown, who had grown to like Egypt, who had perhaps even grown to like their positions as slave. They were suspicious of Moshe. Life as a slave was not easy, but neither is stopping one's life as a slave. So to conclude, I hope that this brief glimpse back in time, looking at both Sefer Shmot and other models of slavery as a foil, helped us realize, one, that unfortunately, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Though the details differ, though the names and faces may change, though some of the facts may vary, many of the basics remain. I also hope that this brief glimpse has helped us all to re-experience Shibud Mitzrayim, and also to recognize that perhaps the experience of Mitzrayim was not just one experience, but perhaps different experiences for different Jews, for different members of Am Yisrael. And finally, I hope that this Pesach we shall all be able to fulfill our obligation, lerot et atzmeinu ki'ilu yatzanu mimitzrayim, to see ourselves as if we left Egypt. And so I wish you all a chag kasher v'sameach. Last, one thanks to Baruch Feldstern for bringing some of the sources about slavery to my attention. Once again, Pesach Sameach.
Thank you, Nima. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your comments to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.